We present The Unbelievable Truth, the panel game built on truth and lies. In the chair, please welcome David Mitchell.
Hello and welcome to The Unbelievable Truth, the panel show about incredible truths and barely credible lies. I'm David Mitchell. It's a show with more fact-checkers than Facebook, Meta and X put together. Yes, we've got one. Please welcome Henning Vain, Zoe Lyons, Ian Smith and Lucy Porter. The rules are as follows. Each panellist will present a short lecture that should be entirely false, save for five hidden truths which their opponent should try to identify. Points are scored by truths that go unnoticed, while other panellists can win points if they spot a truth, or lose points if they mistake a lie for a truth. First up is Lucy Porter. Lucy is one of the most sought-after stand-ups in the UK. Her bank, her mortgage lender, the Inland Revenue, all want to find her. Lucy, your subject is weddings. Ceremonies in which two people are united in matrimony. Off you go, Lucy. Fingers on buzzers, the rest of you.
In ancient Rome, brides were coated in olive oil, and the union was only considered binding if the groom could keep hold of his partner throughout the ceremony.
Henny.
They used to do stuff like that, yeah.
No, not that one.
Leonardo da Vinci had a successful career as a wedding planner, but he fell out of favour because his table plans were always the same. 13 people seated on the same side of the table to make it easier for the official portrait artist. When George IV married Caroline of Brunswick in 1793, he insisted that well-wishers turn their heads away as the couple left St James's Palace because he was so embarrassed at his bride's ugliness.
Ian.
There's a pub called the Caroline of Brunswick, and it's a very scruffy pub. So I don't know if that's been made in the style of an unappealing wife.
You think that it's deliberate by the publican, just that they think it would be historically inaccurate if they turned it into a gastro pub.
Your wife is uglier than a bad pub.
It is not true that George IV asked well-wishers to turn their heads away. He, in fact, married her in 1795, not 1793. Surprised you didn't spot that. And although Caroline of Brunswick was supposedly ugly, and he definitely detested her, apparently the public thought she was great.
King George VI's wedding was not broadcast on the radio in case people listened without removing their hats. And at the wedding of Queen Victoria to Prince Albert, the Archbishop of York politely informed Prince Albert that he would only be required to wear one ring and that it should be on his finger.
Henny.
King George VI was that the one with the stammer?
Yes.
So, yeah, they probably didn't want that stammer on the radio.
Well, that fact is true, but it wasn't because of the stammer. It was, as Lucy said, it was in case people listened without removing their hats.
I mean, I'm disgusted at the idea that there are people at home listening to us with their hats on.
Yes, it does actually makes you well up with hatred, doesn't it? For all that disrespectful rabble. Some of them are naked, you know? Naked and scratching themselves. It's not necessarily 6:30. They're not necessarily doing the washing up or preparing a meal. They could listen to it in the middle of the night on their ruddy apps while they do anything. And I just want to say to those people out there, we know you're doing it, and we are disgusted.
I'm not going to tell you what I do during gardener's question time.
Lucy.
Zsa Zsa Gabor was married 7 times. In 1986, she was admitted to the Betty Ford Clinic in order to treat a chronic addiction to marzipan.
Henning.
Zsa Zsa Gabor, she was married many a time, wasn't she?
Yes, how many times do you think?
7.
I'm afraid it's 9.
Comedy and marriage is never a good mix. Stan Laurel was married 8 times to 4 different women. Richard Pryor was married 7 times to 5 different women.
Ian.
More a query. 8 times to 4 different women.
That's what I said.
Yeah.
So he's I mean...
Double down.
He's married one, divorced, married another, and then gone, no, first one was fantastic, gone back, and then said...
I mean, there are various ways of doing it.
I'd like to quickly go through all the possible ways.
So, Ian.
Yeah, I'll say that that's true about Stan Laurel.
It is true about Stan Laurel. I have the details here. According to the Guinness World Records website, Stan Laurel had 8 wedding ceremonies over the course of his life to 4 different women. He married his first wife, Lois Nelson, once, his second wife, Virginia Rogers, twice, and his third wife, Ileana Shuvalova, 3 times, before spoiling this neat arithmetic progression by marrying his second wife a third time and his fourth and final wife, Ida Raphael, once.
He must have had nightmares about calling out in his sleep, mustn't he, about which one he was with.
But I think some of that would have been back in the day where it was all silent, though, wasn't
it? Oh,
yeah.
It would have been covered over by the piano music.
Traditionally, wedding dresses were canary yellow, but appeared white in old sepia photographs. Yellow represented the positive attributes of custard, jaundice, Labradors and virginity. Incidentally, Virgin Radio was named to celebrate the famous sexual continence and chastity of British DJs. Reflected by the fact that Chris Moyles, Chris Evans, Bruno Brooks, Terry Wogan and Tony Blackburn were all virgins on their wedding day.
Thank you, Lucy. And at the end of that round, Lucy, you've managed to smuggle 3 truths past the rest of the panel, which are that Leonardo da Vinci had a successful career as a wedding planner. At the Duke of Milan's wedding in 1491, he organised not only the menu, entertainment and decoration, but he even designed what guests would wear, including their hats. The second truth is that Richard Pryor was married 7 times to 5 different women. And the third truth is that of all those DJs mentioned, it was Terry Wogan who was a virgin on his wedding day. And that means, Lucy, you've scored 3 points. Erica Eiffel, née Labrie, is a champion archer and advocate for object sexuality, who married the Eiffel Tower in a special ceremony. She'd previously been in relationships with her archery bow, a section of fence, and the Berlin Wall. Slag. Until the 17th century, weddings were officiated by shepherds. They would also provide the music and, in some parts of the UK, the bride. OK. We turn now to Ian Smith. Ian, your subject is teeth, hard, enamel-coated structures in the jaws of most vertebrates used for biting and chewing. Fingers on buzzers, everyone else. Off you go, Ian.
If you're one of those people who are scared of dentists, fortunately, there is a company in London where someone can come to your house dressed as a dentist to desensitise you before your actual visit.
Zoe.
If that's not a business, I'm nicking it and doing that business.
Well, it's not a business, so go for it.
Double-edged sword, that one, isn't it? Yeah.
Dentists are so feared, there has never been a dentist on an episode of Coronation Street, as producers have said it would upset viewers. There have, however, been over 300 murders.
Penny.
Has there never been a dentist on Coronation Street?
No, there has.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, Robert Weston, it was the character name, he was a married dentist who had an affair with Jenny Bradley in 1991.
Oh, now I remember.
Ian.
Dentistry is very much looked down upon in the medical community and was described by Florence Nightingale as a piece of piss. It is a fun thing to say, that, isn't it? In fact, dentistry is considered so easy it is now one of the badges available to Boy Scouts. Giving lollipops to kids after dental appointments was temporarily made illegal by Margaret Thatcher in 1983, only to be overruled in the House of Lords. They argued that this was a traditional practice in the same way that cardiologists often give patients a cigar after successful heart surgery. The Tooth Fairy and Banksy are the same person. The Tooth Fairy is in fact a registered trademark of Colgate. Any parents who give money to their children from the Tooth Fairy are technically in breach of copyright and can be sent to prison. The largest sum of money ever allegedly received from the Tooth Fairy was 1 million rubles to the daughter of Russian oligarch Dmitry Pashatov.
Henning.
There's a lot of truths there. Colgate has got the trademark on the Tooth Fairy and that kid was given 1 million rubles.
Sorry, did you say Colgate? Colgate. That is tremendous. You're going for both those things being true. Well, it cancels out.
Okay.
Because you're right about Tooth Fairy is a registered trademark of Colgate. They trademarked the Tooth Fairy in June 1980, according to Colgate's website. If you provide them with your child's email address, the Tooth Fairy will send them a special message when they've lost a tooth. So that all sounds great, and I suspect they'll use your data responsibly. But it is not true. There is no such Russian oligarch. So the 1 million rubles thing, that's not true, I'm afraid. So.
The Romans used toothpaste made from powdered mouse brains, and the ancient Egyptians used dried dog feces.
Zoe.
Mouse brains, why not? Absolutely. Yeah, mash it up, ground it on. It whitens them, brightens them, mices them. Feel good. Fresh mouth.
You don't have to convince me.
Yeah.
It is true.
It is true. Yeah.
Yes. Ancient Roman toothpaste was made from a mixture of powdered charcoal, human urine, and crushed mouse brains. I don't know where they came up with that recipe. How many other things had they tried? It was widely believed that the ammonia in urine had significant whitening properties, and Portuguese urine was the most prized, as I think we'd all expect.
Is Colgate Latin?
Yeah.
Do you know, is it Henning?
I'm done with that whole topic.
Ian.
As the toothpaste race developed in the modern world, uranium was used to give teeth a healthy glow.
Henny.
I know for a fact the uranium one is true.
It is true. Well done. Yes, in the mid-20th century, the false teeth indentures were made with added uranium due to its naturally fluorescent quality. The first patent for uranium dentures was filed in 1942.
By Colgate.
They were eventually discontinued in 1986.
Oh, my God.
It feels a bit late, doesn't it?
But you never lost your dentures in the dark in those days, did you?
Some animals are incredibly adept at dental work. Beavers can give themselves fillings, daddy long legs use their long legs to floss their teeth, and dolphins have been known to cosmetically whiten their teeth using coral reef. The animal with the biggest teeth in proportion to its body is, in fact, the flea, which, if it were dog-sized, would have teeth the size of an airport Toblerone. That ends my presentation, and I promise you, I have not been lying through my teeth.
Thank you, Ian. And at the end of that round, Ian, you've managed to smuggle two truths past the rest of the panel, which are that American Boy Scouts can earn a merit badge in dentistry. And the second truth is that daddy long legs use their long legs to floss their teeth. Mm. And that means, Ian, you've scored 2 points. One in every 2,000 babies is born with a tooth, a condition known medically as weird freak devil spawn. Next up is Zoe Lyons. Zoe, your subject is shoes, coverings for the human foot, usually made from leather or other durable materials. Off you go, Zoe.
It is considered an insult in South Korea to visit someone wearing socks and sandals. However, in Meinheim, Germany, the practice is celebrated with an annual festival. Socken and Sandalenfest is also... is also thought to be one of the largest gatherings of single middle-aged men anywhere on the planet. Elon Musk only owns two pairs of shoes, one pair of left shoes and one pair of right shoes. Tom Cruise had a pair of shoes with remotely controlled internal lifters, and Prince had 3-inch heels on his flip-flops, making him the only person to pop on a flip-flop to reach the top shelf.
Henning.
That, what's his name again, the Scientology geezer?
Tom Cruise.
Tom Cruise, yeah. I mean, anything deranged, I definitely wouldn't put past him. So he has got them up and down shoes.
Remotely controlled internal lifters.
Yeah.
Nah. Apparently he does wear ordinary lifts, it says here. I don't know what that means. Is it like a thing you put in the shoe?
Yeah, when they think when
then it elevates.
Like an orthotic.
Yeah.
Is that a word? Orthotic? I think orthotic is a word for a thing you put in your shoe if your feet are otherwise uncomfortable. Anyway, if you've been affected by any of the issues. Zoe.
Gallic rule breaker Jean-Paul Gaultier put on a fashion show called Pan Couture and had footwear specially made by bakers, presumably using a robust shoe pastry. Traditional fishermen of the Volendam area of Holland would kit out their firstborn son in a pair of shoes made from herring skins. These kipper slippers... ..would be worn until the child was big enough for their first pair of lobster clogs.
Ian.
I mean, this is just incredibly racist if I'm wrong. I think they make their shoes out of herring.
That's incredibly racist. Oh. No, they don't. Yeah.
Shoe influencer Kitten Heels famously only wears exclusively high-end designer shoes once. But because of a snake phobia, poor Kitten Heels wasn't able to get her hands on a pair of £120,000 shoes encrusted with diamonds, rubies and sapphires that was on sale in Harrods and was guarded by a live cobra. Kitten Heels said, "Snakes? It's hard to imagine bumping into anything creepier in Harrods."
Wow, there is a lot of content to this film.
Barbara Strider is the real-life woman who lived in a shoe. 65-year-old Babs from Oklahoma has constructed her own shoe-shaped house from scratch. The two-bedroom dwelling is her first home, and she built it to get a foot on the housing ladder.
Lizzie.
I feel like I've seen a picture of a house that looks like a shoe, and I'm presuming it's Barbara, whatever her name is.
I think it might be a picture in a story that you've seen. There is no such real woman.
No.
In a glorious example of the shoe being on the foot, or indeed trotter, a piglet born on a Yorkshire farm with a phobia of mud was given little Wellingtons to overcome their fear.
Ian.
I think it's either true or you should write that as a children's book.
Yeah.
Because it's very sweet.
It's the most
sweet.
Adorable thing I've ever heard.
The little pig that's afraid of mud.
Yes.
Yeah.
It is true. Yes, Andrew and Debbie Keeble, the owners of a six-week-old piglet called Cinders, gave her four small Wellington boots, which they'd been using as pen holders in the office, after they noticed the piglet appeared to be suffering from mysophobia, or a fear of dirt. And the boots worked, helping poor Cinders overcome her fear.
Aww.
Mr. and Mrs. Keeble, who keep about 200 saddleback pigs on their 1,000-acre farm, run an award-winning sausage company.
That's exactly the story.
A patent for an American-designed boot with side pockets has finally answered that age-old question of where does a nudist pop their credit card and keys? While this is great news for nudists, it also creates a terrifying world where nudists can comfortably run after you over rough terrain.
Thank you, Zoe. And at the end of that round, Zoe, you've managed to smuggle four truths past the rest of the panel. The first of which is that Jean-Paul Gaultier put on a fashion show called Pan Couture and had footwear specially made by bakers. The second truth is that Prince had 3-inch heels on his flip-flops. At 5'2" tall, Prince owned no flat shoes. All his shoes had heels. Even the flip-flop and tennis shoes had 3-inch wedge heels. And the third truth is that a pair of $120,000 shoes encrusted with diamonds, rubies and sapphires on sale in Harrods was guarded by a live cobra. And the fourth truth is that in 1975... there were press reports of a design patent held by the US Patent Office for boots with pockets made specifically for nudists. The pockets were designed for storing items such as keys, credit cards, identification, and other specialised inserts. And that means, Zoe, you've scored 4 points. It's now the turn of Henning Vane. Henning is from Germany, where he studied at the University of Munster, which last year attained a global ranking of 384, which I think ranks just below not going to university. Your subject, Henning, is board games. Games that involve the movement of counters or other objects around a board according to a certain set of rules. Off you go, Henning.
I've got to say, I mean, this lecture is absolutely cracking, but you'll be the judge of that. The world capital of board games is Wittenberg in Germany, where Martin Luther nailed a Monopoly board to a church door to protest against the Catholic Church refusal to play by the box rules. That's a good start, isn't it?
Lucy.
Germany is huge for board games, so I would say Germany is the capital of board games. None of the rest of it is true.
Well, he said it was Wittenberg in Germany. That's not true. There's no capital of board games as such, though Germans do buy more board games per capita than any other nation. About 50 million a year from a population of 83 million. Henning.
Monopoly was actually invented by the Quaker Lizzie Maggie in 1904. To show how capitalism makes landlords rich and renters poor.
Ian.
I think Monopoly was invented for that purpose, to show the bad side of capitalism rather than the really fun side that it does show.
Yes. You're absolutely right. In fact, that was all true. It was invented by the Quaker Lizzie McGee in 1904 to show how capitalism makes landlords rich and renters poor. It was intended as a critique of capitalism and the wealthy monopolists of her time. 30 years later, Charles Darrow, a domestic heater salesman from Philadelphia, published his own version of the game under the name Monopoly, turning it into a celebration of capitalism and monopolies.
I haven't played Monopoly in a while. Is it contactless now?
According to the University of Minnesota, 35% of Monopoly games end up being thrown against the wall. As games go, it is beaten only in its destructive finale by Jenga and Russian roulette. In second place to Monopoly is Risk, a board game I've never lost. Thanks to my traditional German skill for diplomacy, reasoning and winning over hearts and minds. The game's inventor, the Australian Bruce Barbison, didn't think New Zealand was worth invading, which is why the world map for Risk does not include New Zealand.
Ian.
So I think New Zealand might not be on Risk.
It isn't on Risk. Well done. Yes, New Zealand does not appear on Risk's world map. This omission is most likely due to the Mercator projection, the familiar two-dimensional representation of the Earth with Europe at its centre, which leaves New Zealand squeezed tightly into the bottom right-hand corner.
Board games are synonymous with violence. The most violent people ever, the Vikings, often took board games to the grave with them. Pious Christians are the most likely to lose their rank when playing, though. According to Pope Innocent III, it is not illegal to kill someone after a game of chess.
Zoe.
I'm going to go for the chess one, because they take it very seriously, don't they?
Yeah.
And I reckon you could probably get away with killing somebody after a game of chess back in the day.
Well, certainly according to Pope Innocent III, you could, yes. A Morality on Chess, published around 1250, which is attributed to Pope Innocent III and known as the Innocent Morality, states that if any man plays chess and quarrels as a consequence and kills his opponent, it should not be classed as murder.
There you go.
Ludo is widely believed to be the oldest board game in the world. In Germany, Ludo is known as Mensch, ärger dich nicht, which means don't get annoyed. In Poland, the game is called Nicht schwarz koni, or don't frighten the horses. In Liverpool, it's known as calm down, calm down. But no one ever does. Scrabble started when Gordon Pebbles wanted a game where spelling bee champions could mock the less educated. In the end, even Scrabble was taken over by wrong'uns. It is estimated that 400 games have been bought so the tiles can be used for ransom notes and threatening correspondence. Police are often confused by the blank tile that could mean anything. While criminals are frustrated by the lack of S's. One kidnapper, signing himself as the Sasquatch, wrote a note stating he had sequestered a senator's six sons. Stephen, Silas, Sam, Siegfried, Sisyphus and Sixtus, and demanded 777 million in sovereigns by 6:16 on Saturday. Police simply had to check the CCTV recordings of a shop that had sold him 42 sets of Scrabble.
Thank you, Henning. And at the end of that round, Henning, you've managed to smuggle two truths past the rest of the panel, which are that Vikings often took board games to the grave with them. Board games were an important part of Viking culture and commonly used to pass the time during long voyages. And the second truth is that in Germany, Ludo is known as Mensch ärgere dich nicht, which means don't get annoyed. And that means, Henning, that you've scored 2 points. Which brings us to the final scores. In fourth place, with minus 2 points, we have Henning Vane. In third place, with 1 point, is Lucy Porter. In second place, with 3 points, is Zoe Lyons. And in first place, with an unassailable 4 points, is this week's winner, Ian Smith. That's about it for this week. Goodbye.
The Unbelievable Truth was devised by John Naismith and Graham Garden and featured David Mitchell in the chair with panellists Ian Smith, Zoe Lyons, Lucy Porter and Henning Vane. The chairman's script was written by Dan Gaster and Colin Swash and the producer was John Naismith. It was a random production for BBC Radio 4.
And David Mitchell.